That's just part of the effects of the disease by our reactions to alcoholism.
I am Linda Smith, and I'm a grateful recovering Al-Anon. Hi, everybody. My ego needed taken down a notch or two. Thank you. Didn't it, Jenny? Oh, gosh. It's so good to be here with y'all. I appreciate Milton asking me, and then I get to see a lot of friends that I've known for a while and make some new friends. It's just good to be here, and I appreciate the invitation. Appreciate you letting me be a part of this with you. I always say I'm a grateful recovering member of Al-Anon, but there's been times when I wasn't grateful for anything. But today I can say I am grateful. You know, I found out something in this program. You cannot have gratitude and self-pity at the same time. I've tried. It doesn't work. Every time I'm feeling sorry for myself, if I think of things to be grateful for, I quit feeling sorry for myself. And so that was just an eye-opener to me when I realized I couldn't have them both at the same time. So when I get down, which I still do, I try to remember to think of something to be grateful for. And this morning, I'm very grateful. And like I said, I'm not always, but today I am. But I do thank y'all for letting me come, and I'll try to tell you as best I can what happened, what I'm like today. I mean, how I was, what happened, what I'm like, all that kind of stuff you're supposed to do. I'll start with when I didn't grow up in alcoholism. I grew up in a family. We went to church every Sunday, mother, father, grandmother lived with us, three sisters, and I grew up believing in God. I grew up praying, "Thy will be done." I never meant a word of it because I thought God ought to do it my way. Now, I didn't realize that until I got to this program. I did pray that way and thought I meant it, but I know today that I never meant it when I'd say, "Thy will be done." I always thought that I had the answers, I knew what should be done, and I wanted it done my way. When we were children and playing together, my sisters and I, if they didn't play the way I wanted to play, I wouldn't play with them. It always had to be my way. Now, I used to blame everything on the alcoholic till I did a four-step in Al-Anon and found out that I had a lot of character defects before I ever married an alcoholic, so I can't blame everything on the alcoholic. But I always had that problem of wanting things my way, had to be my way. Well, anyway, I grew up and when I was in school, I always felt that I wasn't quite as good as other people, and so what I did, I acted better than other people. That was my way of coping with things, and today I have to be real careful of that and try to just to be me and not try to be something I'm not. And so anyway, I tried to do that. But when I was in high school, I was a cheerleader and I was into everything because I had to do this to feel good about me. And when I finally finished high school, I went off to college. And now I'd never been around drinking at all. I mean, I remember our neighbor had some beer. I'd go over and play with his daughter and I just thought that was bad. And I do remember that at Christmas, somebody would give Daddy some something and some liquor, I don't know what it was, and he'd do a toddy at Christmas, and that's about all the drinking I was around. So I just didn't think it was good. I didn't think that's what you do. But I became a bad girl after I got to college because I tried it, and I smoked. And but, you know, it didn't do for me what it does for the alcoholic. And I'm sure if it had done for me what it does for you, that I wouldn't be here doing this, because I've been told by a lot of you alcoholics, I just need to go take a drink. But I'm scared to do it. But anyway, so it became kind of sociably acceptable, you know, as I went along. Well, after I finished school, I didn't go to college but 2 years, but after I finished that and got out on my own working, I met this guy. And he drank, but like I said, by now had become acceptable. And we started dating. Well, he was the life of the party. And it made me feel good that I was with him. I needed to be needed and I needed to feel good about myself. So we started dating, and he drank, and it was okay to begin with. Then as we dated and dated and dated, he got, of course, his disease was progressing, and he was drinking more and more, and I, even before we married, began to try to make him not drink as much. So he was no longer the life of the party. He'd drink and pass out, and I was embarrassed, and I tried to make him be okay, you know. Well, after 7 years of dating, I decided it was time we got married. Now, I learned in this program that I have a lot of problems with I deciding anything, but I learned that ego meant easing God out, and that's how I was. I was in charge. I eased God out of the picture. I could handle it. But anyway, I told him that it was time we got married. See, and Brenda talked about this last night, but I always waited for him to get down on his knees and propose like it is in the movies. And we were going to get married, live happily ever after, have a little white house with a picket fence and two children, and everything was just going to be wonderful. And he just never did do it. And so I finally told him after 7 years we were getting married. He said, okay. So we got married. Now, by this time, like I said, I didn't know anything about alcoholism, but I knew he had a problem drinking. But he loved me so much that when we got married, he was going to quit. That's what I thought. Well, we got married, and the drinking got worse. The more he drank, the more I tried to make him quit. And the more I tried to make him quit, the more he drank. I like to say we got on a merry-go-round, and it just kept going faster and faster. But now I had chosen him, and it was my responsibility to make him quit. He was mine now, and that's not a good place to be. He was mine, and he had to do it my way. So I hunted the bottles. I poured out the liquor. I did all the things a lot of you have done that are sitting in here. I went looking for him when he didn't come home. And then the sheriff brought him home one night, and I wish he'd have took him to his daddy. I mean, you know, but I never could. I would tell him, you know, if you just drink beer, it'll be okay. I really didn't know much. So he would hide his liquor and put his beer in the refrigerator. And I never could figure out, he was just drinking a beer or two, how he was getting so drunk. And, of course, I started finding the bottles everywhere. We'd been married about a year and a half, and the drinking was getting worse and worse. His sister was in a hospital in a town about 3 hours away, and she had a 2-year-old son that I kept a lot. And I decided one Saturday when I was off work that we needed to go see her. So I loaded up my husband and the 2-year-old, and my husband always took a nice chest full of beer, and he hunted and fished, and he always took his guns wherever we went. So we get up that morning, and we're going to this town. We're going to see his sister. Well, of course, I drove. He never had any license. Of course, I know today I would have driven anyway because I could do it better than him. But anyway, we get in the car, and he's in the back seat, and he's drinking his beer. He's okay. It's early morning, and he's drinking his beer, and he cleans his guns, and he reloads them. And the little 2-year-old back then was in the front seat. And so we go to this town, and we go in to visit his sister. And I'm trying to visit his sister, take care of the 2-year-old, watch my husband. You know, we can multitask. And I was already into playing the games of let's keep the keys away from him. He had so many DUIs, he was an habitual violator. And so I was always hiding the keys. I never would let him get the keys. But I had a slip. I call it that now. He wanted the keys, and I gave them to him, and he left, well, while we were visiting his sister. Of course, he came back, and today I know that he needed something stronger to drink than beer. He had gone to get something, some vodka. But he did come back, and it was time for us to go. So I got the 2-year-old and him, and we had not eaten, so I had to feed the child and myself. So we went to a little hamburger place right across from the hospital. And my husband was crying. He was upset about his sister. And he said, let me just stay in the car. and I left him in the car and the keys, and I took the two-year-old in, and I was feeding him, and I looked out the windows, and my husband was driving off. So I just left the two-year-old sitting there, and I ran out. He had not pulled out into the traffic in this big town, and somehow I got the car turned off, got him into the back seat, got the keys, went back in, got the two-year-old, got in the car, and headed out of this town. Well, now, I had seen my husband drunk a lot, but I had never seen him quite like he was that day. It was as if he didn't know who I was or where we were or what was going on. And like I said, I can handle anything, so we're headed out in this traffic, and I'm reaching back through the bucket seats telling him I can take care of it all, you know, everything will be okay. He grabs my arm, and I'm trying to drive, and I finally get it back and get outside of town, and he said, pull over at that liquor store. I said, no, I've got to get this baby home. And he pulled a loaded gun on me. And he said, I said, pull over. So I pulled over, of course. Now, I had had some fear, just normal fear, but I had not lived in violence. I'd never been around anything like that. And I didn't know what in the world to do. I was praying. I was talking for my life. And I thought, oh, my God, I got to take care of this baby. What am I going to do? I was trying to tell him who I was, where we were, what was going on. About that time, some friends of ours had from our hometown had also been to see his sister, and they thought the car, we had broken down, and they saw the car, and they stopped. And, of course, when they did, he threw the gun down. And or you might have had a different speaker, I don't know. But anyway, we headed, so that this was strange to me. I knew the woman, but I didn't know her husband. And she knew my husband had a drinking problem. So she took the two-year-old in her car and had her husband come and ride with me and my husband. And I thought, you know, he may kill this man, and I don't even know what to tell him what's going on here. But anyway, my husband settled down, passed out, did something. We got home, and I did what I had to do. I got the baby to sleep. I got my husband to pass out, get him to sleep. And I stayed awake all night. Now, like I said, I had never had that kind of fear. And I put this mind to work, and I thought, now, what am I going to do? Now, I'd only been in that marriage a year and a half. I was 28 years old before we ever married. All my friends were married, all of them having babies, you know, everything was wonderful. I could not be a failure. So, and I didn't believe in divorce. I thought it was wrong. And so it was never an option at that point for me to get out of that marriage in my mind. And so I thought, well, what can I do? You know, so I decided I have really got to make him stop drinking. So I was going to redouble my efforts, and I was really going to make him stop. So the next morning when he woke up, I told him in detail everything he had done. And I really believe today he was in a blackout. He didn't remember any of that, now that I know what a blackout is. But he was scared. It scared him, too. And he promised me he'd never drink again. And I believe today that he meant that from the bottom of his heart. But he didn't know how not to drink. And, of course, in a few days, he was drinking again. And that merry-go-round's going faster and faster because, by gosh, I'm scared. Now, I have never had never been quiet and never stuffed anything. I've always been a talker. But I stuffed that fear down inside, and I thought, I can't tell anybody what happened. And I just kept it inside, and it was eating me alive because I couldn't talk about it. But I knew I had to do something. I really had to make him quit. Well, this is still early in the marriage, and he's still drinking, and things are getting worse. In 1977... I would go, finally, there was this preacher that I could talk to, and I finally went to this preacher and told him about that, what had happened, and of course, you know, sharing something like that begins a healing process, and the more I talk about it through the years, the more I have healed from that fear that I had. But anyway, so this preacher knew a little about alcoholism and about treatment centers and Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I was talking to this preacher about everything, and he told me, well, we need to get him to go to treatment. So we talked him into going to treatment in 1977. Well, I just thought it was, you know, this was going to be wonderful. So the preacher took us to the treatment center, and we were young still, and got him checked in. And now, I was relieved that he was, I was really upset to leave him because, you know, nobody could take care of him like me. But I left him there, and then I was relieved that I had some time to relax and rest a little bit, because it's a full-time job looking after y'all. I'm telling you. If you do it good. But anyway, so while he was in treatment, I was actually 12-stepped. There were these two Al-Anons from a town nearby that came. They called me. They came over. They brought Al-Anon literature. They told me about themselves and then invited me to an Al-Anon meeting. So I went to my first Al-Anon meeting in 1977. Well, it was wonderful. You see, he had gone for the cure, but I was doing the good thing. I'm a good wife. I was doing what I was supposed to do. So I went. I got his mama to go with me. We went to that meeting. It was a speaker. She was funny. I got literature. I thought it was wonderful. I thought he was a sorry drunk, and this had a good name. I thought alcoholic was a good name for him. It wasn't as bad as drunk to me. So now I had a name for him, and so this alcohol, I have. He's in treatment, but he's gone for the cure. One of the things I learned in Al-Anon, one of the first things were the three C's. I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I can't cure it. Well, see, I thought he'd gone for the cure. He was going to get fixed. He's going to come home. We'd never have this problem again. Of course, I didn't know anything about alcoholism. And, of course, through the years, he told me that it was my fault that he drank. You know how we blame each other for everything. And so I thought I'd caused it. Now, part of the time I didn't, but there were times after years of living in it that I began to believe, well, maybe if I could have been prettier, maybe if I could have done this, maybe if I could have done that, he wouldn't have had to drink. And so I started blaming myself for his drinking too. And also control, well, you have already learned, I'm sure, very quickly that I have a problem with control. And so I had thought that that I could control alcoholism. I knew I kept looking for that magic thing. If I could just find it, I could fix this, you know. But I had to learn that I could not control it. But anyway, he's in treatment. And it gets time for me to go up there to the family visit. And I go, and we're young, and he cleans up good. And, oh, the honeymoon's great, you know. Everything's great. Because I thought I go to my first AA meeting, and they take us out to an AA meeting when I'm at the treatment center. I just fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I just thought it was wonderful. Back then in 77, the smoke was so thick you couldn't even see each other in the room. But I just fell in love with the alcoholics, you know. And I just thought everything was going to be wonderful. We got home and he got drunk that night. Now, they had given him an AA contact, but he didn't call him when he got home. So the seed had been planted for Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. Because I had been to that meeting, and they, of course, in the treatment center, they told me about Al-Anon. But I didn't need anybody because I was still in control. And so from 1977 to 1984, I was still in control. And even though the seed had been planted, I didn't think about that as a solution to our problem. So I decided that he needed a psychiatrist. He was crazy. And if he could just fix, if I could get all this stuff fixed, then he wouldn't have to drink. So I started taking to a psychiatrist. Now, we lived in a little town, Fitzgerald, where I am now. I drive him to this town about 2 hours away. I take off work, use my insurance, take him to this psychiatrist on an outpatient basis, week after week. Well, he'd drink his beer on the way up there, and he'd drink his beer on the way back. And after a while, I thought, you know, that psychiatrist's not helping him. I'm going to talk to him again. And they were not going to let me talk to him, but they did, because I let them know I was paying the bill. So they let me go in and talk to him. You know what my husband had done? He had convinced that psychiatrist that I was the one with the problem. And what I didn't know at the time, I did have a problem. This is a family disease of alcoholism. But see, I didn't think I was being affected whatsoever. It was just if he'd just quit drinking, everything'd be okay. That's what I thought. But I know today I really did have a problem too, but I didn't think so then, so you better believe he didn't go back to that psychiatrist. One time I put him in a psych unit for 7 days, in a med-surg hospital because I just had to get him straightened out. And he came out of that hospital and he looked at me. Now, he was not a violent person. If anybody was violent in that marriage, it was me. He was not. He looked at me when he came out of that 7-day treatment lockup, and he looked at me and he said, "If you ever put me anywhere else, I'll kill you." And that fear that I'd pushed down inside just came back up, you know, and I thought, oh, I'll never do anything else, you know. Of course, that didn't stop me. In a few days, I was trying again, trying to find a solution to this problem. But anyway, in 1984, his parents came to me and said, "We need to get him some help." And I said, "I'm not putting him anywhere." I remembered what he said. And they said, "Will you talk to him with us?" And I said, "Of course." Well, we all thought he just had psychiatric problems that, you know, needed solving. And so this psychiatrist that his sister had seen before when we went up there to this town, we decided we'd get him to go talk to him. Of course, I had his bags packed. I knew I was leaving him. But anyway, so the family ganged up on him. It was at night. And we talked to him about going to talk to this psychiatrist. And he agreed. This is in it was in 1984, June of 1984. And but it was nighttime, and I wasn't taking him till the next morning. Now, by this time, living in active alcoholism, I had built these walls up because it hurt too badly to feel. I didn't want to, and I got where I couldn't really laugh, couldn't really cry. I just didn't want to feel these feelings. And so after his parents left, and he left to do what any good alcoholic would do because he knew he was going off, he went to get drunk. I was there at the house, and I thought, I can't take him. This was the same town, the same place where he'd pulled the gun on me. So all of a sudden, the floodgates opened. I just started crying, and I thought, I can't do this. So I called that preacher that had helped us in 1977. Well, he had a funeral, and he couldn't go with me, but he said, "Don't go by yourself. Get his mom or daddy or both to go." Well, I convinced his mom to go. And, of course, the next day he didn't take his beer and guns because mama was with us. We took him to this psychiatrist and put him in, and I told him, the psychiatrist, all these problems he had. I barely mentioned the drinking, of course. It was all these other problems, I thought. I was so wrong. Well, anyway, after a few days, they called me, and they said, "We've opened an alcohol and drug unit at this hospital, psych hospital. We want to move him over there. He needs, his alcoholism needs treating." Well, I thought, how dare they think they know more than I do? But they did it anyway, and they did know more, because I know today there are a lot of problems that go along, of course, we all know, with alcoholism, but you've got to treat the alcoholism. But anyway, they moved him over there, and they would call me, and I was so glad he was gone this time, but I didn't have that, I didn't think he'd gone for the cure. I had lost hope. I didn't think there was any way out. I just needed a break, and I put him somewhere else, you know. And so I didn't have that hope, but it got time to go to the family. Well, before that, they called me, the counselor called me and said, "See, the one thing I hadn't done, I'd never left him. I'd never tried leaving him." The counselor asked me, would I tell him that if he didn't do something about his drinking, that I wouldn't be there when he got back. And I can honestly say that I was to the point that I just couldn't go on like that. So I did. I told him that while he was there. So he, it got time to go, and I went, it was just a couple of days, and I went up there by myself and went in there, and like I said, I didn't have that hope. They gave him a AA contact number to call, and we came home, and he called an AA contact. I guess the threat, you know, that I was going to leave if he didn't stay sober. So we started going to meetings. Now, I couldn't get him sober, but I was going to keep him sober. So off we go to meetings in all these little towns around every night. And the first few nights, all of them were AA, open AA meetings. So we'd go to these meetings, and I'd sit there. I'd punch him. I thought he ought to hear what they were saying. I knew he wasn't hearing it. And then we'd get in the car to go home, and I'd tell him everything because I knew he didn't hear it. And there wasn't a thing wrong with me. I didn't think. One night we were sitting there. before the meeting drinking coffee, and this guy said, this woman told me, she said, "You need to be in this other room." And I thought, how dare she? I knew about Al-Anon. I'd gone to one meeting in 1977. But it was the first time there was an Al-Anon meeting when we started going. So I went into the Al-Anon meeting in June of 1984, and I stayed, thank God. And so I went in, and I remember that woman turning to the back of our One Day at a Time daily reader and telling me I needed to read the pages on controlling. Well, I wasn't offended. I didn't know I had a problem with control. So, and I got all the literature, you know, all the free pamphlets. I bought books, and I just started absorbing all this stuff, you know. I thought it was wonderful, and there was a little ray of hope. Now, my first hope was that he was going to stay sober, of course. I was still so focused on him. At every meeting, they would say very gently to me, "Take the focus off the alcoholic and put it on yourself." You see, if they had allowed me to continue to talk about him and focus on him all these years, I would have never gotten better. But it was a slow process, but slowly Al-Anon was for me to take the focus off him and take care of me. Because, see, I found out I was sick, that I had certainly been affected by this disease of alcoholism, and that I needed help. And so anyway, I stayed. We kept going to meetings and to Al-Anon and AA. And one day, they told him to make 90 meetings in 90 days. Well, it was probably just a month, maybe 2 months. I can't remember now. He came in one day, and I knew he'd been drinking. I could just see it in his eyes before I even smelled it. And I didn't want to do what I had always done. I did not know at the time what a big impact Al-Anon had made on me to that point. And I had just started. But I went back to my bedroom and got my One Day at a Time book and started reading in the back about slips. It talks about AA slips, but it talks about our slips too. And I thought, because I didn't want to do what I'd always done. So I went back in there and I looked at him. Instead of what I did before was jump on him and tell him what he needed to do, I didn't do that. I looked at him and I said, "I know you've been drinking, but I can't do anything about it." Now, that was a big step. Not that I totally probably meant it, but I said it. And I continued to go to meetings. He continued to drink. Once in a while, he'd go, drinking or not, with me. But I continued to go to meetings, AA and Al-Anon. Well, he didn't get sober, and he didn't get back into AA. But I kept going, and I got scared again because he started doing some very irrational things, and the guns were always there. And an example that really scared me, well, it wasn't unusual for him to, we lived in a mobile home. It wasn't unusual for him to shoot holes in the mobile home. He saw a snake over there. I didn't see it, but he was having hallucinations, and he'd shoot a hole in the floor. But anyway, one of the times that I really got really scared was, he loved dogs, but he had drank his hunting dogs away, you know, and he just had this little mutt. And one day I was threatening. See, I wasn't too well. I just got in Al-Anon. They told me not to threaten, but I was still threatening. And I was going somewhere, so I got in my car, and he said, "You don't need to go down. You don't leave right now." And I said, "I'm going." So he takes his gun and kills that little dog in front of me. Just something very irrational when guns were concerned. But anyway, I had gotten really scared again. And I didn't know what to do. Because I'd heard in the program not to make a major decision in the first year. And it was only like 6 months. But I knew I couldn't stay there anymore. I was too frightened. And he was still drinking. So we were living on the farm, on his parents' farm in that mobile home, and I just took my few belongings and I left. Now, at first, I wouldn't tell him where I was going because I was scared. And I have to be honest enough to say this is the one thing I hadn't tried. And he was drinking again, so I had not tried leaving. So, and I'm sure in the back of my mind, I thought this may work, he may get sober. But anyway, I left because I was scared. Well, I was in the same count, near there, but I left, and I didn't tell him where I was. And I heard my sponsor. I got a sponsor right away when I got in Al-Anon, and I heard her share this story about something similar had happened. And she would not tell him because she was scared of him. But when she finally did tell him, that she told him, if you come here drinking or drunk, I'll call the law. And she said, if you say what you mean and mean what you say, he'll hear you. And so when I finally let him know where I had moved, I did tell him that. Well, my pride was hurt. We stayed separated 9 months, and he never came to see me. He knew that I meant it, and he was drinking or drunk. Now, he would come sometimes when I was gone to work. He knew my schedule because I worked. And he would come and leave things on the doorstep, you know, flowers or cards or something. And he would call, sometimes drinking, sometimes not, sometimes begging me to come back, sometimes cussing me out, you know. But he never quit drinking. So this went on, and I'm still going to Al-Anon and to AA, Open AA. And by now, I'm trying to really do what I'm told in the program. I'm praying only for the knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out. I'm trying to turn my will and my life over to God. I'm trying to not be in control. I'll never forget when I did that fourth step and realized I was a controlling person. I went to my sponsor and I said, oh, this is horrible. I didn't know that. And she said, Linda, you did the best you could at the time, but you know better now. And so she wouldn't let me get away with it anymore. Not that I didn't try. But anyway, so I'm still going to meetings, and I'm praying. I'm really praying about that marriage because I tell y'all I didn't believe divorce was right. And the way I was brought up in the church, and nobody in my family had ever gotten a divorce, you know. But I just knew I couldn't live in active alcoholism anymore. And after 9 months, and I have to get honest enough to say that there was this guy in AA that was after me. And I would go to those open AA meetings, and he'd try to get me to go out with him, but I didn't think I should, just separated, you know. I'm still married. So I wouldn't go out with him. So after about 9 months, you know, I decided that I wanted to go out with him, so I got the divorce. And then God did for me what I could not do for myself. That guy started running the other way. And the reason I say that was good was because I was talking to my sponsor one day, and I was telling her things about this guy in AA that, well, this needed changing, this needed, you know. She looked at me and she said, Linda, what you going to do? You think you're going to do, change him? Well, I learned just enough to say, no, I know I can't change anybody, but I think I'll be a good influence on him. She said, you better look at that. So here I was again, trying to find somebody that needed me and that I could take care of, that I could control. That's why I say God did for me what I could not do for myself, because this guy ran the other way. Now, didn't mean I didn't try to get him. Because you don't tell me I can't have something. That just tells me, go get it, you know. But I didn't, and I'm grateful. At least the program clicked in, and so I didn't. So I keep going. I get into service work. My sponsor takes me to assemblies and AA conventions, Al-Anon conventions, all these weekends, you know, and I'm going everywhere, she and her husband, and meet a bunch of people that I've known for years, even sitting in here at these things, and just, you know, going along pretty good. Got the divorce, like I said. I dated a few of those earth people. Y'all know what they are. They're not in here. You know what? They were boring. They were boring. I just love alcoholics. Y'all are exciting people. So anyway, so we're going along, and at one of these weekends like this, it's called Serenity Weekend at Jekyll Island, my sponsor and her husband introduced me to a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a little connection there, but I found everything wrong with him. He was too old, too fat. He really wasn't fat. But, you know, but I was still kind of after that good-looking guy, you know, that was running for me. But there was a little connection, and I would see this man. His name was Rip. Nickname was R.I.P. Rip. And I would see him at assemblies. I would see him at conventions. You know, and we became friends. He'd take me out to eat, and that was good, and I liked somebody else paying for my food. And so we just were friends. He lived about 77 miles from me. And once in a while, through that a year or so, he would call. And finally, at another weekend that we went to, he asked me, could he come see me? And well, we were good friends, and I didn't have anybody at the time, so I said, sure. Well, he came to see me. We started dating, and in 6 months, we were married. I said I was all right till he kissed me. Oh, my Lord. I have to tell y'all this. I am terrible. You know that fantasy I had about the husband getting on his knees and proposing? Well, I told Rip I wanted him to do that, and he did. Now, I'd been in Al-Anon a couple of years, and I would have told you, no, I didn't feel that way, but I did it. Nobody knew we did that, but he did. He got on his knees and proposed. Couldn't get up, but Jenny and Chet knew him. They know who I'm talking about. But anyway, he was a great guy. But anyway, we got married, and I moved from Fitzgerald, my little town, to Waycross, Georgia, about 77 miles away, and got in an Al-Anon group there. And we were doing great, you know. Now, I had never had those children, and by now I was 40 years old. And he had children, two grown children in their 20s, but he knew how badly I wanted children. So we talked about it. He said, let's just leave it in God's hands. I said, okay. So I got pregnant on the honeymoon, and I lost that baby before I even knew I was expecting. I was 6 weeks, and I miscarried. Well, I wasn't too upset. I thought, well, hey, I can get pregnant. I never had it before. And so I worked real hard for 2 years to get pregnant again. And when I was 42, I got pregnant again. And I lost that baby at 3 months, and I was just devastated. You see, I had this fantasy of what life should be, and I should have those two kids. And Rip didn't want me to try again. I was 42 years old, and he was getting older, and he'd gotten hurt at the railroad and, you know, all kind of stuff. And well, I had then about 5 years in the program probably, and I would have told you I had a great conscious contact with God and that I really had this program. We were really in service work. We were really speaking. We were really doing all this stuff. I was doing an Alateen group. I was, you know, doing all this stuff. I was really into everything. And I thought, you know, this is that I really had a good program. But it went out the window. When this happened, I got angry. When I lost that baby, I also lost the fantasy, the dream. I knew it wasn't going to be like I thought it was going to be. And so I'd cry and carry on. The only two things I did right, I kept calling my sponsor. I'd cry to her. And I kept going to Al-Anon. Now, I wasn't happy with any of you. I just sit there and go to the meetings, but I was not okay. But you know why I wasn't okay? I wasn't okay because I had lost that conscious contact with God. One night, Rip and I were laying in the bed, and he said, Linda, I was talking, crying, carrying on. Mad at him, too. And he said, have you ever thought you might be angry with God? And I thought, me, good little Christian that I am, no. And then in the next breath, I thought, God, why did you let me get pregnant if you were going to take my baby? And I realized I was angry with God. And I had never been there before through anything. And so when I realized that, I started doing some things differently. I heard somebody share that they prayed before they got up in the mornings, because when their feet touched the floor, their mouth came open. Well, I identified. So, and I also heard somebody say that they thank God for what they had. And so I started praying a little differently. And eventually, when and how, I don't know, I got back even a stronger conscious contact with God than I had had before by doing this. And I began to love, be okay with God. Then, of course, when I was okay with God, I was okay with people, myself, my husband, and other people. So things began to get better again. And like I said, I don't have what I thought I was going to have, the little white house, the picket fence, the two children. But I have a wonderful husband that loves me unconditionally. He'd had to live with me. And We bought a house. It wasn't white with a picket fence. It was brick, but we finally bought a house. And I was at an Al-Anon convention one time, and somebody said to me, "You know, you may not have children." That's when I was grieving the loss of the children. Said, "But God has given you so much more." At that time, I was sponsoring a lot of people, and I had a lot of people that I was working with. They said, "Look what God has given you." And so I realized that I had so much more than I would have had if I'd had just what I dreamed for. And so Rip and I started speaking, and we were getting to travel all over the place and meet people. And things were good. Like I said, I'm still in service work, and I've done all these different duties, and I'm alternate delegate at this time, and my world's good. Everything's going great, you know. Now, Rip and I, he used to say in his talk, we got along real good, and we had a good marriage, but he said, "Oh, those times when neither one of us was doing what this program says." He said, "Now, if I was, or if Linda was, everything was fine, but if neither one of us were, it wasn't." But anyway, we did have a good marriage, and one of the things that was the best thing that we had going for us is we remained friends. He was my best friend. Well, in 1995, my world fell apart. My sweet Rip was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And I thought, I just can't do this. I just can't lose him. So I get into my role of, I've got to make everything okay. And he's got such a good AA program. And he would sit there and he'd say, "Linda, it'd be okay. Just pray for God's will. Just pray for God's will." And I think, we got to pray for healing. He's already done one miracle. You're sober. We got to pray for healing. And I'd get all carried away, you know, and he'd just be so calm. And people would come by the house. It was just a steady flow of AA and Al-Anon friends. They would come by and they'd say, "I don't understand, Rip, why you?" He had started a halfway house for men. He was really working with a lot of alcoholics. He just did a lot. And he would look at them and he'd say, "Why not me? Why not me?" And there was one AA friend, good friend, that later on told us, said, another AA was talking to him and said, "You know, I don't understand why Rip, and I just don't understand any of this." And the guy said, "Well, look, Rip has shown us how to live this program, and now he's showing us how to die." And he did. He lived 6 months, and he showed us how to die. He died with dignity and grace. And like I said, he kept going till he couldn't. We went to even convention that year, and when he could, we went to things, and he went to meetings, and people were in our home. But for the way I handled it was, like I said, I didn't want to pray for God's will. And I had really done that, and I really wanted it. But I didn't want him to die. And I didn't want to say, "Thy will be done," and mean it anymore. But I knew I needed to. And about a month or so before he died, a friend came to the house to sit with him, and I had to go do some stuff. And I got on my knees, and I said, "God, help me accept whatever your will is in this." And I guess I got some measure of acceptance at that point, not total, but I had some relief. Well, in January 26, 1996, he wanted to stay at home, and the last 5 days were the only days he was bedridden. And, of course, I could handle anything, so I didn't call in hospice till the very last minute. I should have got him before that, but anyway. And those 5 days, I had help. And we had the opportunity to talk. He knew he was dying. I knew he was dying. I would ask him things. And, you know, we'd always didn't have any problem sharing and telling each other how much we loved each other. We could do that already. But when it's death staring you in the face, it's hard to talk about things. I had to ask him about the funeral and about some things, you know, and what he wanted. And he said, "Oh, you can handle it." I thought, yeah, I can. But anyway, we did have the opportunity, and I'm grateful for that, because so many people die instantly and you don't have the opportunity to tell them bye. And I did have that opportunity. But anyway, on that day, January 26, 1996, I called hospice because of his medicine. And the girl that was head of hospice in that town at the time was an Al-Anon. And she was at the house, and I was saying, and you know, they try to prepare you, but you're talking about denial like we have with this disease. There's denial there too. They had told me that when he started to die that he could gasp for breath, you know, how it would be. And his breathing was real shallow that morning, but I couldn't think that he was going. I mean, you know, my denial was there. But anyway, I was talking to her in the living room, and I was telling her that. She said, "Let's go. He's going." And I was on the bed, in our bed, holding him in my arms. And he sat up all of a sudden. And I said, "What did you see?" Of course, he didn't say anything. But I know he saw the light. Because you see, when he died in my arms very peacefully, just taking a little breath, I felt God in that room. I felt the presence of God take him home. And I never had experienced anything like that in my life. But anyway, well, I got to pull it together because I got to look good. And everybody's coming in the house because they knew he was dying, you know. And I'm grieving, but I got to look good. I mean, you know, and get through the funeral no matter what it takes. So people came in. Like I said, they knew he was dying. And they all were there right away and were very supportive. And the funeral was an AA kind of funeral. Well, it was preachers doing it, so it was AA and preaching. But I get through the funeral, and everybody but my best Al-Anon friend and one of my sisters were still there. And, you know, I just, then they had to go home, of course. And then I just thought, God, I just want to die. I don't want to live. This is just too hard. And I'm by myself. I don't think I was suicidal. I didn't try to kill myself, but I just wanted to die. It would just be easier to die than to grieve. Well, God was not through with me, and I had to work and support myself. I was 49 when he died. We had 9 years and 3 months of very special, special marriage. And so I had to go to work. And you know what else I had to do? I had to go to meetings. A good habit's good, isn't it? That's what I do. So I got up, I went to meetings. I had a lot of support. I grieved very hard. Well, let me hurry. About a year after he died, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. Now, I would have told you if I was told I had the big C that I would panic, you know. But I thought, thank you. I said, great, God, I can die and go and be with Rip. I was still grieving so hard a year after he died that was my first thought. But you know how I am. The next thought was, but God, I don't want to hurt. Still trying to tell him what to do. I just can't get better, can I? And God was good. Mine was caught very early. I had both breasts removed and reconstructive surgery, but it was caught so early I didn't even have to have chemotherapy. So what did I do? What do I do? I keep going to meetings, I keep working, and I keep trying to work with other people. And I ask God, well, what am I supposed to do? I'm kind of at a loss, you know. What am I supposed to do? I don't know what to do. And I heard at a meeting said, you just ask for God's will and put one foot in front of the other and keep going. You know, just do the next right thing. And so that's what I kept trying to do. And, of course, I was speaking and different places. And one time I was speaking during that first year after he died, and all of a sudden I thought of the footprints in the sand. When there's two sets of footprints when you're walking by God's side, and there's one set when God's carrying you. And I was talking about that, and I said, you know, there's been one set of footprints because I know God's carried me through this. It's the only way I could go. And I said, and I think he's put me down, and I wish he'd pick me back up. And it came out of my mouth before I even thought, you know. But it's the truth, you know. Sometimes God carries us when we just cannot go ourselves. And then he puts us down to walk by his side and hold his hand. And when I'm holding your hand and your hand and your hand, I'm holding God's hand. And I've got to tell you one other thing before I close. That first husband that I divorced, he never remarried. I never stayed in touch with him because I'd remarried and moved. I stayed in touch with his sister and his mom and dad, though, through the years in our hometown. And I knew he was still drinking, you know. And I got a call from his sister. Well, Rip died in 96. I had cancer in 97. And in 98, I got a call from his sister saying that they'd found him dead at his house. He had drank himself to death. He just could not get it. He was in and out of AA some. He was one of those unfortunate ones, maybe constitutionally incapable of being honest. I don't know. But he couldn't get it. Of course, they called me, wanted me to come. I went to the funeral, and I thought, oh, I should have done something. Rip and I should have helped him. You know what I forgot? I forgot step one all over again. We're powerless over alcohol. I couldn't help him then no more than I could have helped him all those years I was living with him. I was powerless over it. I had the opportunity to be with his mom and sister, who I used to give a fit back in those days because I'd try to make them go to Al-Anon and I'd try to make them read that stuff and I'd try to make them quit enabling and all this stuff, you know. And his mom was grieving so, and she said, oh, we did all the wrong things. And I said, listen, you did the best you could. He had a disease called alcoholism. And there was no cure. And I said, and you couldn't have fixed him if you'd tried. And I had the opportunity to tell his parents and his sister that. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful I had that opportunity. And I never made amends to him because he wanted me back. I got letters from him in between Rip dying and him dying, trying to get me to come back. But I couldn't go back in active alcoholism. And so I had not seen him all those years. And I needed to make amends for me. Well, somebody told me the best amends I ever made for that man is to get off his back. Probably was. People tell me stuff all the time like that. I don't understand. Anyway, I had the opportunity to go back. Of course, he was dead in the casket and make my amends. And that was for me. And I'm grateful I did. But anyway, life goes on. Rip's been dead 11 and a half years. Doesn't seem like it. Almost 12. It'll be 12 in January. And I still miss him. I've dated two times, but they just weren't interesting. I don't know. We won't go there. But anyway, I keep working. I keep going to meetings. I keep trying to talk to people that needs help. Guide them in the right direction if I can, you know, to Al-Anon. And I'm back in Al-Anon in the group I started in. I was telling somebody there's nobody there that was there when I started. But there's all new people. Maybe God's put me there for a reason. But it's been a good move. I moved back, finally sold mine and Rip's house and moved back to Fitzgerald, my hometown. I have a father who's in bad health and I have a sister there. And I didn't want to go into this, but I lost after Rip, 2 years ago, this past May. I didn't have children, but my sisters shared their children. They were just like my own children and grandchildren. So I'm blessed. And I didn't tell you this, but after I lost that child, Rip's son and his wife had a little girl, and I got to be Mimi. So I got to keep her a lot. She's 15 now, and I don't ever see her. But anyway, I got to keep her a lot when she was a baby. And my sister's children and all her grandchildren. So I'm real blessed, and I have a lot of children and grandchildren. But anyway, two years ago in May, my sister, the mother of my youngest niece, who was 34, married with a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old, and a husband, and she taught elementary PE, and she was on her way to work and got her mom to come down there. She taught PE, and she was having a field day, and she was taking over a little inflated swimming pool, the blow-up kind, to use. So her mother, my sister, was driving the truck, and she was in the back of the pickup truck on the pool, and they went over a concrete bridge, and wind got up under it and threw them out, and she had severe head trauma. They got her rushed. My sister thought she was dead and that she'd killed her child, and they rushed her to Valdosta to the hospital, and she never regained consciousness, and the next day the doctor said she was brain dead. And it was so devastating to lose my baby. There's my baby niece, and like my own child. The Mother's Day right before that, she'd given me a present. They always gave me a corsage for church, but she gave me a present too. And they treated me like I was the grandmother for their child too. But anyway, that's been devastating, and I don't know how well I'm dealing with that. Tell you the truth, because I've tried to be there for my sister and keep her from going insane with it. But anyway, y'all pray for us. We still need that. I didn't mean to get into that. I don't even know where I was going, but I'm fixing to close. I know these seats are hard. Because I sat out there last night. Anyway, we're doing okay, really. My family has been blessed. My sister, really, and brother-in-law, and all the other kids. And we've really been blessed to get through all this by the grace of God. I want to close with something my husband always used with his talk. He said he never had anything original, that he stole it from somebody else that he heard do it. So I'm stealing it from him. I waited till he'd been dead over 10 years before I stole it now. And I've given him credit 3 times, and he said after 3 times, that's enough. So I ain't giving him credit after this. But this is just something he closed with. It talks about what I was trying to say a while ago, is how I've made it through all this, and about holding your hand. Says, I was in a forest, and I was lost. I didn't know the way out. A hand was extended to me. This is what that hand said. Linda, you're in this forest, and you're lost. But see, I know the way out. If you'll take my hand and hold my hand, I'll help you out of this forest. You may have felt a rougher hand, a smoother hand, a stronger hand, or a weaker hand. You've never felt a hand that extends to you the love that this hand extends. Just walk by my side and hold my hand. Now, don't walk in front of me or behind me. We may encounter many quagmires and many stumbling stones before we get out of this forest. But see, if you'll just walk by my side and hold my hand, you may stumble, but I won't let you fall. Just as we begin to get to the edge of the forest and you can see a ray of light, please don't turn my hand loose, because if you do, you'll get lost again. But when I've led you safely out of this forest and you know the way out, then it will be your responsibility to go back into the forest and lead another lost person out. God bless you. Thank you.